Welcome into the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Folks, I am so excited for today's program. We have an old friend back with us, Jim Harold. Jim is a forefather of podcasting. He is the man when it comes to telling campfire stories, when it comes to telling tales of the paranormal, tales of the spooky, tales that will engross you, engulf you, that will scare you. And so I am so glad to have him back on this program. He has a brand new book out there, True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire Volume 6. It's out there right now. We have a link to it in the description of this program. Let me tell you a little bit about Jim before we get rolling here on the program. Jim is the host of Jim Harold's Campfire and the Paranormal Podcast. Of course, he is the best-selling author of the Campfire series and president of Jim Harold Media. Jim launched the Paranormal Podcast in 2005, which is the longest-running paranormal podcast on the internet. Jim Harold's Campfire, his most popular podcast, recently celebrated its 15th anniversary. And Jim has become a full-time podcaster, has been since 2012. Jim also worked in broadcast radio for over a decade with a variety of stations, including time spent at CBS Radio. He also worked in the technology, newspaper, and B2B media fields and has taught at the university level. Jim's also been featured on outlets including Coast to Coast AM, Fox 8, and Beyond Belief with George Norrie. He's the author of the best-selling Campfire series, as I mentioned before, and these stories, folks, are amazing. In True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire Volume 6, which is out right now. Let's bring him in and welcome him back to Darkness Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Jim Harold. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Tim, it's always great to catch up with you and great to be in Darkness Radio. And I got to say this, I always say that I have the longest running paranormal podcast on the internet, but it was very close because Darkness Radio was just, I think, a couple months behind me. So before I start putting on there, I'm like, let me double check, you know, is Darkness before me? Because it very well might have been. So I think we're kind of, I see us as kind of compatriots in that we were both there at the beginning. And what a ride it's been. Very blessed to do it. Love doing it. And then when you guys started with Darkness and I started with the Paranormal Podcast, people were like, what's a podcast? And there were barely any paranormal podcast. And now there's thousands of paranormal podcasts.
Oh my gosh, there's so many.
We're still here and we're still ticking. So I'm sure you agree we're not giving it up to the youngins yet.
No.
And I don't feel like I'm that old, but I was very young when I started, very young.
Oh,
and plan on doing it for a long time to come, hopefully, God willing.
Yes, God willing. They're going to have to pry this microphone from our cold, dead hands.
Exactly. Exactly. I had a boss when I worked in classical radio. He was the announcer for the Cleveland Orchestra, and he said they were going to have to pull him out of the booth feet first.
That's a good one, yeah.
And I kind of feel the same way. Yeah. It's like, but I can't die now. I've got to interview that person about ghosts. And it's like, no, you're going to be one shortly. But anyway.
So that leads to the next question. So do you find yourself waning or waxing in passion when it comes to this field as you get older? Do you find yourself more titillated by the subjects, or do you find yourself at times going, you know, as I become closer to becoming a ghost, do I need a break from it at times, or do I find myself more enthralled with the subject?
You know, I brought this up without being asked on other podcasts lately, other radio shows and things, and I actually am more interested than I've ever been. You wouldn't think that. What else can you talk about for almost 20 years and not get bored with? And the thing is about, and I'm sure you find the same thing, Tim, because you hear a ton of stories and talk to a ton of people about these subjects, is that somebody always has a new perspective. Mm-hmm. Somebody always has a new idea. Somebody has a unique experience that you've not heard before. Just the other day, I think it was the day before yesterday, or maybe, you know, it was Monday night. I was doing some recording for the Campfire Podcast and people were calling in with their stories. And I had a woman who had a visitation from her grandfather. Now, if you follow these stories, you think, oh, how sweet, well, how reaffirming. But it was quite the opposite. It was quite sinister. And there was a whole background story to it that we'll be sharing on the show. But the point was, I had never heard quite that configuration of events. I think the reason it does not become boring, and the reason I'm still interested, very much so, is because there's always something new. And I don't think anyone, you know, knows all the answers. Even someone like, we were just offline talking about the late, great Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I think she knew as much or more about these subjects than anybody. Or people like Lloyd Auerbach, or the late, great Brad Steiger. But even those greats don't know and didn't know everything.
Yeah.
So I think there's always something to learn.
When you look at, you mentioned Rosemary Ellen Guiley, when you look at how prolific she was as far as books, I guess here's the next question. Six already as far as campfire stories go, and the submissions keep mm-hmm. coming. You talk about how many stories people have and the amount of topics in Campfire Six here as far as the length and breadth and how many different types of paranormal topics are in this book. People have different types of experiences every day that can be considered paranormal. Does it ever shock you, the type of experiences that you get in the, as far as submissions?
Well, it kind of, you know, I have to say something about the book title, True Ghost Stories. And there are ghost stories in the book, but there's things that are not ghost stories. So it really probably should have been called True Ghost Stories and More. But yeah, it does. You know, when I started this in 2009 now, which seems incredible to me, you know, I thought it would be mainly UFO stories, ghost stories, you know, very straightforward. I saw Aunt Mildred and those kind of things. But there's so many things that come up that I wasn't expecting. Doppelgangers, mm-hmm. time slips, shadow people, things that are uncategorizable. And that's the category that I'm most fascinated by. I call them head scratchers.
Yeah.
So the thing is that the straight ahead ghost story is actually probably a minority of stories that we get on the campfire. And it's interesting. And something as simple as lost objects. And there's a thing called JOT. It was kind of, and maybe you're familiar with this. Mary Rose Barrington was a researcher and author over in Great Britain, and she passed away, I think, around 2020, 2021. But I'd had her on the show about something called JOT, just one of those things, where things would turn up in very unusual places, and it would have some paranormal significance. And we started getting, I had mentioned this on the show, this interview, and all of a sudden we started getting all these JOT stories of things turning up in weird places, inexplicably.
Hmm.
And the thing is that there's like new categories, it seems like, all the time. And I think that it all, you know, I think it all kind of goes to the point that our existence is far more complex than we give it credit for. I think that the world is a lot more complex than we give it credit for.
You know, doing supernatural news in the last couple of weeks, you see stories about now scientists think the universe is actually alive when they talk about, you know, different stars and dark matter and planets and whatnot. So if we're talking about vegetation being alive, if we're talking about stars being alive, if we're talking about matter being alive and everything thinking and feeling and having a consciousness, does that freak you out at all? I sit up at night sometimes thinking, I'm a little freaked out about this, that if everything has consciousness and thought, there's a lot more to this. I mean, I used to think that the ground I walked on didn't think back.
Yeah. It makes you think, like, if you have, like, you know, how people used to have old TV sets and bang on the side of them, maybe the TV set, you know, felt badly about that.
Right.
If it were conscious.
Or got angry.
But the point is, This goes very much to the point of what I was saying with the existence being very different than we think it is. I think we see like a small sliver of reality. And I think having done the campfire gave me a vantage point to say, hey, there's a lot more going on here than you think. For example, everybody, you know, a bunch of my dead relatives could be in this room with me and I can't see them, kind of like ultraviolet light. Hi, Mom. Anyway, but I've been doing that joke. Sorry, Mom, man, you're going to get mad at me and haunt me. But the point is, Mr. Greatly, but the point is that, you know, just because we don't see something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. DNA. Mm-hmm. You know, DNA has been around as long as we've been around, but we didn't know about it and really understand it since the last 50, 60 years. So just because we can't measure something and we don't understand something doesn't make it where it doesn't exist. That's where I part ways with science. You know as well as I do, we're similar vintage. To do what we're doing right now, I know kids take it for granted. By kids, I mean like people in their
20s. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They feel like, oh, it's just the way it is. You know, Zoom, FaceTime, it's all the way it is. Used to have to be Ted Koppel, for those of you who don't know who that is. He was a huge network anchor and used to have satellite time to do what we're doing right now from home studios. You used to have to be a network and have satellite time.
Yeah.
And a big satellite truck and all this crazy stuff. And now we're doing it from our home office. That is a miracle. And that's due to science. So people say, oh, you don't believe in science. And I'm like, no, science has done great things. The medical advances over the last 10, 20, 30 years, amazing. But I think where, in my opinion, science gets in trouble is this. Science is so good that it gets overconfident. Yeah. And they say, well, if we can't measure something, if we don't understand something, if we're not picking up on something in a scientific context, it doesn't exist. And it's like that old Donald Rumsfeld thing. There are, what, known unknown. There are things that we know that we know. There are things that we know that we don't know. But there's things that we don't know that we don't know. Unknown unknowns.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of unknown unknowns out there that we don't understand. Science doesn't understand. And science is a little too egotistical. By science, I mean the scientific community. Say, oh, if we don't understand it, we don't know about it, we don't have an inkling about it, we can't weigh it on a scale or measure it in a test tube, it doesn't exist. And to which I say, bullpucky. There's a lot you don't know that exists. You're doing great work in so many areas. Keep doing it. And maybe a lot of this stuff is the science of the 23rd and the 24th century. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, that's fine. You know, they say the more things change, the more they stay the same. You look at science of even the turn of the 20th or the 19th or the 18th century, it seems like they all go back to trying to study death. But then the scientists that tried to study death, they get kind of poo-pooed on and they say, no, that's too fringe. You get some scientists that manage to get a little bit of funding to study it. They push the field a little bit further and we get little, it seems like we get little nuggets, little bits and pieces of, well, we're almost mm-hmm. there. We're on the fringe or on the veil, using a little bit of a pun there. And they come up with a new theory, and that latest theory being, I guess, that maybe heaven is a quantum universe. That
may very well be possible. One thing, when you talk about death and near-death experiences, that's one of my absolute, people say, what's your favorite topic? I think that's going to be right up there, because not everybody's going to necessarily see a Bigfoot. Not everybody's necessarily going to see a ghost, even though the afterlife obviously plays into the question of ghosts. Not everybody's going to see a Bigfoot, but everybody, whether you believe in survival beyond physical death, which I do, mm-hmm. or not, we've all got to, there's an old spiritual, you've got to walk that lonesome valley, you've got to walk it by yourself, and ain't nobody here going to walk it for you, you're going to walk it by yourself, and truer words have never been spoken.
Right.
So we all are going to die physically, mm-hmm. and the question is, what happens, if anything, next? Near-death experiences fascinate me because it gives a little bit of a glimpse into it. And the skeptics say, oh, that is just the throes of a dying brain. That is just, chemicals released to ease the dying process. Well, riddle me this then. If you look at the studies of people like Dr. Sam Parnia and so forth, you see that at times people can report things that they couldn't possibly have knowledge of. While they're flatlining, while they're unconscious, they float above their bodies, they explain what's being done in very precise terms, and they're able to report it back with accuracy. Now, how does that play into those chemicals going into the brain to ease the dying process? Even if you don't put any stock in the light, you don't put any stock in the life review, and, you know, seeing of religious figures or loved ones, all that, if you think that's all, horse stuff, how do you explain that? And that's the thing to me. So I love that subject. One quick story about that.
Sure.
I had a guest on the Paranormal Podcast, and I always forget his name. He was such a good, his first name is Bruce. He's a doctor. And he did a book called After. And he pretty much started off as a scientific materialist, skeptic, that kind of thing. But over time, and he doesn't assign it to any certain religion or anything like that, he became someone who is convinced there's something to these near-death experiences. And the story that he told was, is that one experiencer had a near-death experience and reported back that they saw their surgeon flapping their arms like a chicken in the surgical ward in the room while he was being operated on. And the doctor thought, oh, this makes no sense. Why would a doctor, a surgeon, flap his arms like a chicken while he's doing surgery? Turns out the surgeon was interviewed. The surgeon was very concerned about keeping instruments sterile. So, and I don't know if you folks can see on video, but I'm holding my arms up. The surgeon would point with his elbows and say, give me a scalpel, give me some sutures. And he would point with his elbows, which would give the illusion of flapping his arms like a chicken. But the patient would have absolutely no way of knowing that. So how do you explain that? And like so many of our stories on Campfire, I think there's two distinct possibilities. One, the person is lying, which I don't believe.
No.
I mean, the stories that we put in here, the people that I felt, and most people who call in, I think, are extremely sincere. Either they're lying or they experience something which might possibly be supernatural or paranormal. So that's kind of where I stand on it.
That's a fascinating story. I had my own out-of-body experience when I was young. I've told it before on the show. I won't waste your time with it. But it's, to me, after that, scared me so much, Jim, I shut myself down. I don't know. I didn't want to experience it again because in that moment, I saw my great-grandfather die. I didn't want to experience it again because it scared me. But at this late age, I think I would probably want to experience it again because to me, it's fascinating. At this late age, it's fascinating now. I know that I didn't kill him, but at that young age, I thought I did.
By virtue of having the out-of-body experience, you thought that's why I died.
Yes, exactly.
It scared you. And that's understandable. I think I do remember this. You were, what, 8 or 9 years old?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was very young. Yeah. Very young. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I remember. So you thought that that's why he passed away.
So
That's tough. That's a tough one because a young person, you know, doesn't have the coping skills to understand, you know, that death happens. And the thing is that people will ask me about Campfire. Does it freak you out? Can you sleep at night? Those kind of things. And the truth is, it actually, and this might seem really weird, I wonder what your experience is. It's comforted me in a way.
Yeah.
Because we collect all kinds of stories. We collect stories of like heartwarming, sweet affirmations, signs from loved ones. And I believe that's a part of the picture. And then we also have stories about evil entities and the devil. And I happen to believe those things are real too. And I always have believed that life is a continuum, you know, in our everyday lives. There's good, bad, happy, sad. And I believe that that's a reflection of the supernatural, is that it's not just all good. And, and my New Age friends, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, they tell you, oh, there's no such thing as evil. There's just lower vibrations.
I don't buy
and
that.
And they have a lot of interesting things to say, and I think they have a lot of value to provide, but that's where I disagree.
Yeah.
I think evil is very real, and some people call him the devil or whatever. I think all that's real. Some people say I'm superstitious. That's okay. That's their right to say that, but I think evil is real. And I think good is real. And I think when presenting a collection of stories like this, my goal was to, and the same with the show, is just give the full scope.
And I don't know if you agree with this or not, Jim, but is it your outlook on this that there has to be a balance in nature, that with good there has to be evil, with light, dark, with black, white, that there somehow in this crazy world we have to balance things? Is that just why evil exists?
I don't know if it should be that way, but I think it is that way. I think to think that we can achieve in any way of life some kind of utopia, I think every system, everything that man creates is fallible in some way. You know, my book isn't perfect. My podcast isn't perfect. God knows I'm not perfect. So I think you're on to something there. I don't know if there should be evil. I wish there weren't evil. But I just think it's the nature of the beast. I think it's human nature. I mean, it's kind of like, I think when you deal with people, you have to realize that all of us have our shortcomings. All of us have our faults. I think, I don't want to get political or anything, but I think that's something that we need to learn again, that nobody's perfect. Yeah. And people do things they shouldn't do sometimes, and people say things they shouldn't say sometimes. And, you know, just spotlighting on those things alone and not looking at the totality of that person. And maybe they're a horrible person. Maybe, yeah, you're right to cast them aside, but maybe you're not. None of us are perfect. All have, what does it say in the Bible? All have fallen short of the glory of the Lord. Now, mm-hmm. whether you're Christian or whatever you are, I think there's something to that concept that we've all fallen short of the divine.
That's right.
So I just think it's the nature of humanity. I mean, if you go back and look at it from a religious perspective, there's reasons that there's evil and so forth. But, you know, I just think it's the way it is, regardless of your religion or no religion at all. I think there's good and I think there's bad.
You're absolutely right, my friend. Absolutely right. This book, I gotta tell you, you and I want to give credit to your team. You and your team have done such an excellent job on this book, and there's such variety in this book. You're right. It spans not just ghost stories. It's everything in itself. I tell you what, let's take an early break. When we come back, let's talk about some of the subjects in this book and some of the stories in this book, as it is rich in different stories. There's one story I got to tell you, Jim. As my listeners know, I've struggled a little bit with Sharko Foot. There's a podiatrist story in this book that absolutely freaks me out. I want to talk about that story right off the bat because I'm going selfish on the bit here. And it is so Twilight Zone that. Gosh, this is the one that freaked me out in the book. We'll talk about it when we come back. And there's lots of interesting stories. There's a curse story in here. You know, I've talked about curses on this show that I believe curses are very real. We'll talk about a curse story that comes straight from Sicily. We'll talk about that when we come back. There's so much more. Folks, this book is absolutely amazing. I encourage you to go out and get it. Jim's podcasts are amazing as well. We'll have links both to the book and to the podcast in the description of this program. Jim Harold has the Paranormal Podcast and the Campfire Podcast that you need to check out. And, of course, the book is available right now. It is True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire Volume 6. And it's available right now. We have a link in the description of this program. When we come back, some stories from True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire Volume 6. When we come back, right here on the best in paranormal programming, this is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Jim Harold. He is the host of the Paranormal Podcast and of Jim Harold's Campfire. And he's got a brand new excellent book out there, folks. I encourage you to go get it. It's in the description of this program. True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire, Volume 6. Jim, this book, boy, I'll tell you, read it from cover to cover, and I read it very quickly. It is such a good book. And of course, you've gathered these stories from the listeners of Campfire, and they're the best of the best. And what I love about this is that you have not altered them in any way. They're as pure as can be. You might have changed one or two names, just, of course, for the protection of the people in the mm-hmm. story. But they come across as not only pure and organic, because not everything's a jump scare. Not everything is meant to shock you. Sometimes the story just lays as it lays, and it truly comes across as organic. Tell me why it's important to you to have these stories as authentic as possible.
Well, when folks sign up to the show, you know, I let them know and during the sign-up process, we might end up using this in a book. And I want to do that from the start just to make sure everybody knows what the playing field is. And in trusting me with their stories, I thought it was so important that I respect the stories. That, you know, if somebody's driving a red car, I don't turn it into a blue car. So what we do is we take the stories, we obviously transcribe them. And, you know, it's a dialogue between me and the person. Mm-hmm. So for reading purposes, I don't leave it that way because, frankly, that would be, you know, maybe a little boring if it's just like a transcript.
Sure.
So I take me out of it. And then if I ask a question, like if I said, well, how did you feel? And they say, oh, it felt very eerie and quiet. I just, you know, incorporated and said, the mood was very eerie and quiet. So we do that. We correct for grammar, you know, and not that I'm the world's greatest grammar expert, but we work on that and clean up the grammar. We clean up the flow. We might reorder, not when things happen, but sometimes people, when they're telling the story, they'll tell you A, B, C, and D, and then they'll forget, oh, I forgot to tell you this about B. So we make sure that it's in a good order and just clean it up so it reads well. And knock on wood, I've not had one complaint from anybody who's ever been featured in the books in terms of how we've presented their story. And I'm proud of that.
That is an accomplishment because it really is hard to please people, especially when you put their story out there. I think some people you would think would have an issue or two, but that is really an accomplishment. That is a great accomplishment.
Yeah. Knock on wood.
Yes. Knock on wood. You have some amazing stories here, my friend. One of the ones that absolutely freaked me out, and talking as a guy who has a diabetic foot condition, and sees a podiatrist on a weekly basis. And by the way, I have my podiatrist into the show. He's not a paranormal guy at all, but mm-hmm. he'll ask me when I come in. He'll ask me, first of all, about what's going on with the true crime show. Then he asks me what's going on with the paranormal show. And he likes to hear about the different guests and whatnot. And he'll ask me, you ever have anything that's related to the show? I now have a story to tell him.
Yeah, this was something else. And I had forgotten about, because these stories, since we hadn't done a book for several years, these stories go back a few years, and I'd forgotten about this one, but this really is freaky. This is called A Podiatrist's Paranormal Past, and I believe it was Kate from Missouri, and I've got it here for reference. She was about 9 or 10 years old, and her best friend had a knee injury and had a knee brace, and she was getting a lot of attention at school and so forth. Simultaneously, our caller started to get this sharp pain in her foot. And she went to the school nurse and so forth, and they kind of blew her off she's just, you know, she's feeling jealous. Her friend's getting all this attention. She wants to be in on it, that kind of thing. She went to the school nurse again. They blew her off again. Finally, her dad said, let's figure this out. We are going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to take Katie to the doctor. And this pain was in the area of the big toe of her right foot. And she said it was so severe, she was walking on the outside of her foot and worn out all of her shoes. So they gave her an x-ray as a precaution, figuring out there wasn't going to show anything. When they got done with the x-ray, the father comes back in the room where Katie is sitting and says, and has this ghost white look on his face. He says, she asked, what's going on? What did the doctor say? And Katie's dad said, he's going to have to explain it to you because I don't know what it is. And the doctor asked her if she had stepped on anything. And she said, no. And he said, well, there's something in your foot and it's quite large. It was a metallic object inside of her big toe and it was almost as long as the toe itself. And due to the discomfort she was having, he speculated that it had been there for 6 to 9 months.
Oh.
And keep in mind, she never remembered stepping on anything. There was no puncture wound, no draining, no infection. So they sent her off to surgery, and she said, can I have it when you're done? Can I have this thing that's in my foot? And they're like, sure, no problem. She went in surgery. She ended up going home and she did not get the item, whatever it was. Apparently, her mom said they did show it to her, and this thing looked like a very flattened, probably at least 1 inch long needle, and it looked like it may have been from an old phonograph record player. And I mean, this is probably in, I'm guessing, in the 90s, 80s or 90s. I mean, that makes no sense. So Kate was 9 years old. She was blown away. She didn't know what it was. Now, the thing was, is that she was particularly puzzled because there was no puncture wound. If you ram something in your foot an inch long, there is going to be some kind of puncture wound.
Oh, yeah.
But there was no puncture wound. At the time of telling this story, she's 34, and you can still see the incision scar from the surgery. She said she was very level-headed as a kid. Movies didn't scare her, nothing like this. But this freaked her out. She said that one odd thing was, about a year before the surgery, she walked into a bookstore and saw the cover of Whitley Strieber's Communion, and it totally freaked her out. But she doesn't know why. She was terrified of grays. Now, she did some research and learned about potential alien implants, and she wonders, you know, could she have been a victim of that? She also said that she found a conspiracy theory where there had been a program to track children born between something like 1968 and 1979. Well, she was born in 1979, so she thought maybe that was it. But she's never really been able to figure it out. And kind of the twist in the tale is, what does she do today? She's a podiatrist. So,
how's that for a
she doesn't know what caused this and how this, I mean, think about that. In any part of your body, you just, like, something metal, and not like a lot of times with these implant stories you hear, it's the size of a pea, it's the size of,
right.
We're talking an inch long. I mean, and just to walk around with that, that's painful. Oh my gosh.
I can tell you this much. Here's how I related to it, Jim. When my foot broke down, I was at the phenomenology out at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I was my leg bone was ramming down through my ankle and through my foot, and flown on it out through from Milwaukee and from Minneapolis to Milwaukee out to Gettysburg. I'd walked around on it all weekend. I had a cane with me because it was so painful, but it had swollen like 4 or 5 times its size. I didn't know what was going on. I thought I had an infection in my foot, right? Walking around on it, came back, and the hospital that looked at it said, you don't have an infection. We need to get you to a podiatrist to look at it. They did a standing x-ray. The podiatrist that was on duty said, I got to send you to a specialist, and didn't tell me why. He wouldn't tell me why. And I'm like, and they said, we have to send you to this Dr. Pena, who's the only surgeon in the Midwest who works on, he teaches at the University of Minnesota. He's the guy in the Midwest. They have other surgeons who work on Charcot foot, obviously in Chicago, but he's the guy. So I go and I see Dr. Pena. And he tells me, you have 117 breaks in your foot and ankle.
Oh, my Lord.
And he said, we're going to look at the x-ray once. That's the only time I'm ever going to allow you to see it. And he said, from here, we move on. And I'm like, okay. And I looked at it. And it looked like when you see when you first see the opening shot of a disaster movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just devastated. I went, that happened over a weekend? He said, yeah. He said, now we're done. And he goes, get it out of your head. He said, now we start over. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
And when I'm listening to the story and I think of that thing in her toe and just walking different, people don't realize, you know, how much pain that is to sit on a different side of your foot and walk like that for 6 to 9 months to me, it's just a nightmare to think, well, something got put into your foot. You don't know how it got there. There's no, because something that big, if it goes into your foot, it should fester. It should, It should, in fact, you should see it. And you shouldn't be able to put up with it for more than a day or two.
Yeah, and that's why I do wonder about the alien implant angle on this.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, could that have happened to her? And the fact that she had the visceral reaction to the communion book cover?
Yeah.
Could that have happened to her? And I mean, this whole thing about her friend and the knee was just a coincidence. I mean, yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, how do you ram an inch-long piece of metal in your toe without knowing it?
Yeah.
You
yeah.
don't.
You don't. You don't. One of the other things on the show that absolutely has fascinated me is the curse, the supposed curse. When I was growing up, my grandparents and my aunt used to joke that there was a family curse. You know, she used to say, oh, yeah, it's the Dennis curse. But there's one from Sicily that was absolutely intriguing, and I don't, they call it the evil eye. I don't remember what the Italian,
the Malocchio.
The Malocchio, that's what it is. But that was completely intriguing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and this one hit home with me because a couple reasons. My wife is Italian, so I'd always heard about the evil eye. She wasn't Sicilian, but she's Italian, and the Italians and the... Well, there's a whole thing between Italians and Sicilians, but they're Italian. They're all Italians.
Yes, yes.
But anyhow, it's a thing for, you know, people in northern Italy as well. And so I got very familiar with people talking about the Maloic and so forth. And then we just had, maybe this last summer, last year, had Antonio Pagliarulo on, I believe it is, who wrote a book called The Evil Eye. Fascinating book if you're interested in this stuff. Mm-hmm. And Antonio kind of educated me because we would go see my wife's family. And I remember this one older member of the family. Like if you bring over the new child, a new baby, or you have a new car, she would almost say something like, "Oh, how beautiful. God bless." And I never know why she always said God bless. But Antonio explained to me that there's different kinds of evil eyes. There's the intentional ones, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And then there can be the inadvertent ones that are through some kind of internal jealousy that you're not aware of.
Really?
So by saying God bless at the end of the phrase, you close off that possibility.
Okay.
Huh. So, oh, what a beautiful radio show you have, Tim. God bless.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
So I'm not wishing you ill.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. One less curse for me.
Yes. So anyway, on to the story, the Malocchio. So this was Eddie from Chicago, and he's a first-generation Sicilian-American. And like most Italians, he was raised devout Catholic, but on his dad's side of his family, they did have a little dalliance with Italian witchcraft. Eddie said they called it la vecchia religione, the old religion. Now, his family didn't really practice it very strongly, but mainly as a protection thing. And even my wife's family, my late father-in-law always had a horn in his car. Mm-hmm. And, the evil eye was definitely considered a thing. So anyway, Eddie's story begins when he's 17 years old. His family is going to take him on a trip to Sicily as a gift, you know, since he's about ready to go to college and everything. And Eddie said he went and they were having a fantastic time. Now, he had heard of the next door neighbor of his family over in Sicily, the grandmother's neighbor. She was strange and had a lot of hatred towards Eddie's family. Apparently, Eddie's dad had dated her daughter, and that didn't work out. And then the woman made accusations against members of Eddie's family, and just she did not like Eddie's family at all. She was mean and not very likable. So one day they were in Sicily. Eddie was in Sicily with his family. They were getting ready to visit some other family. They went outside, and this woman comes out, this neighbor lady, and she started screaming out something in Italian dialect or Sicilian dialect that Eddie couldn't understand and threw a dead chicken at him and his family.
Oh!
And Eddie's like, what in the world is this? And he couldn't make out what she said because he knows Italian, but this was a dialect. And his mom explained, she just put the evil eye on us. But don't worry about it. We'll say a quick prayer and everything will be fine, because his mom really wasn't a believer. And that comes into play later in the story. But she really didn't go for this stuff. It was more her dad's side of the family. So anyway, they spend the 2 weeks in Sicily. Everything seemed fine. But then they got home and everything changed. Eddie said their home had always been very peaceful. But once they got home, there was a lot of angst and anger and tension. They'd walk into a room and there'd be cold spells, and the house wasn't very drafty. There would be nasty smells, and the house wasn't usually smelly. Not only that, there was infighting among the family. The sisters of the family always got along until now, and now they were at each other's throats. Then mom and dad started arguing, and they never argued. So then it ramped up, as we often see in these kind of cases. The activity ramps up. So one night, the mom of the family is sleeping, and this is a person who doesn't believe in any of this stuff. She said she woke up, and she knew she was being stared at. Eddie's dad was asleep in the bed. She was up, but she still felt someone else was in the room. She sat up, looked around, didn't see anything, tried to go back to sleep. Then she felt an icy grasp around her ankle, and something was physically trying to pull her out of the bed and physically moved her. She jumped up and she started screaming and crying. At first she thought her husband was playing a joke on her. He wasn't. And she was so beside herself and believed so much that this happened that she refused to sleep in bed and went downstairs to sleep. And this was really a line in the sand for the family, because she was the one that said there's nothing to this stuff, nothing to worry about. But yet she was attacked about it. And that really kind of, Eddie said, freaked out the family, freaked out the kids. Then one night, Eddie woke up and he felt a heavy presence in his room. From the corner of his bedroom, there was a tall, wide spot that he said was beyond pitch black. It looked like a hole cut into the universe. It was bobbing up and down like it was breathing. Every time he closed his eyes, it seemed to be getting closer. He grabbed the rosary they kept by each of the children's beds and thought, okay, this has got to go away. He tried to say a prayer he was taught as a kid, but couldn't remember the words that he had learned when he was five. Couldn't get the prayer out. He started hearing fast, heavy breathing. It was like a panting sound, and he got closer. He closed his eyes, turned his head, and when he looked over again, the blackness was right beside his bed. He shot up and ran for the door, but his legs felt like metal. He couldn't move. He couldn't run. He couldn't do anything. The more he struggled, the worse it got. He started getting nauseous, like he came off of a tilt-a-whirl. And finally ran out of the room and to his parents' bedroom and said, look, there's something going on here. This happened to mom. This happened to me. We're all fighting. Everything's going wrong. The next day, they called the parish priest, blessed the house, and it went away. And Eddie just goes on to say that he thinks that the Sicilian tradition of the old ways is very beautiful, but there's also truth in the fact that one of the deepest human feelings is jealousy. And unfortunately, when something good happens to someone else, some people want it so desperately, they're willing to do anything to get it, or at least get revenge on the person who got what they wanted.
Isn't that?
And that's Eddie's story of the Malocchio.
Isn't that?
And
something?
It was a good one,
huh? I you know, there's some people that absolutely believe curses aren't a thing. I do.
I
think that not only do people have the power of intention and have it so strongly that they can put it out there, but I also believe that if people want to take that power in and believe it and put the power of belief behind that power of intention, it's very, very powerful.
Well, I do, because, you know, the thing is that I believe in the power of positive thinking. So, I mean, in a way, if you believe in the power of positive thinking, I think you've almost got to think of the power of negative thinking, too. You know, I'm the kind of person who believes, let's say you've got a desire to put a nice car in your driveway. If you work hard and you think positive thoughts, and I'm going to save up and I'm going to get this car and I'm going to work hard for it, I think that can make it more likely that that will happen. I don't mean I can just sit here and say, oh, I want a nice car in my driveway. But if you work towards it, or in your career, if you say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to work hard, and I've got positive feelings, I've got confidence, I think it comes through. Conversely, I think if you've got negative feelings, that comes through. But I think that same rationale can be applied to negative things too, that you can, whether for yourself or other people, I think that you can generate negativity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of stories in the book that have to, they have a feeling of, was this paranormal or was it happenstance, or was there something that happened in reality that could be construed as paranormal? One of the ones I want to deal with, or one of the ones I want to talk about, is actually kind of one I found a little funny. It's called the paranormal polka. This one, now here's why I find it funny, Jim. And there's, you know, I worked out in the wilds of Wisconsin in radio. As you know, you've worked in radio as well. There's a thing where one type of music can be misconstrued as another. And I'll set it up as that. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
With
okay.
that, do you remember the story of the paranormal polka?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us a little
bit
about it? And I
will say, on my video here above my head, you see the Cleveland sign.
Yes.
Cleveland was the home of the polka king, Frankie Yankovic.
Yes.
And I remember, and it was probably the same way up in the upper Midwest there. We used to have a TV show when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. Every weekend, Polka Varieties, it was called. Yep. And they would have, and I grew up in a Polish neighborhood, so I was very familiar with polka. So anyway, this is called the Paranormal Polka. And this is Jill from Vermont. And this is one of those sweet little stories. Jill had a grandma who had grown up in Luxembourg. And she loved polkas. And every time that Jill would go visit, Grandma would be playing polkas. And Jill thought it was because her grandma reminded her of home. I mean, I think we all do things like that to remember us, whether it's a geographic place or it's a time we play music to bring us back to us. And that's why her grandma loved polkas, specifically the beer barrel polka. And Grandma lived with him as long as she can remember. They had a little apartment downstairs, and Jill would spend a lot of time, and she's always playing, Grandma's always playing the beer barrel polka on her record player. So unfortunately, Grandma died in 1986. And Jill had a really tough time. She was very close with her grandma, so it was very hard on her. A few months later, her mom and her aunt went to Florida. It was for her birthday. They visited Epcot and had dinner in a Mexican restaurant. And Mexican music played the entire evening. It was a busy place with a lot of people. And after the dinner, the waitstaff came out with a small birthday cake. And she couldn't believe what she heard as they walked towards her with the cake. But all of a sudden, the beer barrel polka came out of the sound system. Jill said it was just amazing. I said, oh my God, what is going on here? The servers wished me a happy birthday and left unaffected by this strange choice of music. The beer barrel polka finished and the Mexican music resumed for the rest of our time there. A polka was entirely out of place and different from what anyone would expect in a Mexican-themed restaurant. And apparently, her mom and her aunt confirmed what she heard, said, yep, that's the beer barrel polka. And they seemed as stunned as she did.
Now, do you see?
So that's the story of the paranormal polka, but I'm interested in your theory.
Do you see the big smile on my face right now?
Yes.
Okay. I'll tell you my theory on this one. And people are going to say, Tim, you racist. But no, here's the deal. Okay. So I've worked both at a radio station where I had to spin polkas at 6 o'clock every night. I've also worked as a operations manager for 3 years for a Spanish-speaking Mexican radio station where they spun all different types of Spanish music, including flamenco and different types of Mexican music. There's a lot of accordion and fast-moving accordion music that sounds like polka. Okay?
No,
so if you ever sit in a Mexican restaurant for any amount of time, you'll hear music that sounds like polka. It sounds a lot like it. There's a few different songs that sound like the beer barrel polka. I can't name what they are. I've heard a couple of them sitting in a Mexican restaurant.
Can I give you a further theory?
Sure.
A follow on. does not necessarily mean that it wasn't paranormal, because maybe somewhere, now that she has ultimate wisdom, Grandma knew that and specifically
asked,
aligned things that Mexican song that sounded like the beer barrel polka played. Just
yeah.
a thought.
Yeah. And that's what I'm thinking, is that song that sounded like the beer barrel polka happened to play at the time where, you know, I think that's more kismet or, you know, more of a happenstance than, or, you know, the minute I read that story, Jim, I went,
I'll give you one that happened to me that a lot of people say isn't paranormal, but I think is.
Sure.
So, and it's very similar. Mm-hmm. I think mine's got a little more kind of weird elements to it. So we were talking about the great late Rosemary Ellen Guiley. In 2017, yes. I was with her and Micah Hanks on a paranormal cruise. And I was one of the speakers, and I happened to have a bit of a cold. So we were in a little conference room because it was a sea day. So that day we all gave talks. And I'll tell you, it's a tall order to try to follow Rosemary Ellen Guiley on a talk. It's kind of like, okay, I might as well go blah, 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 blah. She's so great. But anyway, so, you know, my throat was bothering me a little bit. So I said, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to the cafe before and get a little bit of coffee. Somebody yes, brought indeed. Me some coffee.
Here. There you go.
And anyway, so to get out right outside the conference room, in their wisdom, they put the casino, the cruise line. And as soon as I stepped out, I saw one of the members of the attendees to the cruise group. They were playing one of these crane games where the crane comes down and it grabs money. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that I had an uncle who had passed in 2013. And he was like a second dad to me. I was very, very close to him. He lived with us. I mean, very close. He was like a third parent. And he loved those games. He would play those games at any kind of store, you know, Walmart, whatever. They would have it, you know, he would drop, you know, 10, 15 bucks just to try to win a little thing that was worth maybe a dollar.
Yeah.
It was the sport of it. And I said, and he also liked to gamble just a little bit, like on football pools and lottery tickets, nothing big. Mm-hmm. I said, man, he would love this. I wish he were here right now. Boy, I have a very specific thought, and I think that it caught my attention more because the guy from the group was playing, so it really caught my attention. I'm like, man, I wish he were here. All of a sudden, this woman walks up next to, and maybe I've told you this before, I don't know.
No.
But the woman walks right up to the machine. She cups her hand like she's calling out for someone, and she says, John, John. Within 30 seconds, her husband or whoever it was, John, shows up. The funny thing about that, my uncle's name was John.
Really? Interesting. No,
So that's very much like the beer barrel polka. See, I wonder sometimes if our loved ones, maybe not all the time, but sometimes they can pull some strings and they can make things happen. Did somehow he make sure that guy was playing that machine at that time so I would think about him? Or is it so instantaneous that the fact that I thought of him very intensely, very specifically, very lovingly, made him say, I'm going to put all this in place so Jim can know I'm thinking of him too. And again, it could be a coincidence. I like to think that it's much more than a coincidence. But just one of those weird, as you said, kismet, happenstance.
Right.
Is it that, or is it just too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence? I don't know.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a very good point. One of the other stories that's here in the book that is one of questionable circumstance. We won't call it coincidence. This is one of questionable circumstance. Has to do with a young woman who's babysitting at the time. This happens.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And this is a freaky deal where
And this is one of those stories because, you know, most of the stories we get are firsthand, right?
Right.
This happened to me. But occasionally we'll be have someone that tells a family story, which I think is good too. I mean, you know, somebody may have passed, or maybe they're of a certain age where they're not interested in being or able to be on a podcast. So this was a story about our caller's grandmother. This is Christina from Oklahoma. And her grandmother had told her this story when she was a child. And her grandma's still alive when she told this story. She may very well still be alive now. And she said, okay, grandma, you told me the story when I was a kid. Is this the story? And she said, absolutely. Now, she says that her grandmother, never prone to fantastic stories. Skeptical woman, religious, but very reserved. So this story has resonated with Christina for many, many years. The story occurred in Germany, where Grandma was born and raised in a very large family. And Grandma's older sister was asked to babysit for a couple next door. Now, the neighbor's baby was very young, about 18 months old, and recovering from a cold. Now, he was a good baby. So the couple told her, don't worry about it. You should be fine. He's probably just going to sleep most of the night. So Grandma's sister agreed eagerly. Started out as a pretty easy evening. Baby was a little bit cranky when children are sick. That's the way they are. But Christina's, I guess that would be great aunt, put him to bed. And the baby was quiet most of the night. Grandma's sister was downstairs knitting, entertaining herself, when she heard him let out a blood-curdling cry, the baby. He hadn't cried all the night, so she ran right upstairs, dropped what she was doing. When she reached the door, apparently Grandma's sister said there was a stereotypical figure of death on the baby's bassinet, but with one difference. The Reaper was small. It was the baby's size, only 2 feet tall, perhaps. This little Reaper was on the crib's edge looking down at the child. The figure didn't have a face or anything like that. It was just a black figure with no distinguishable hands or anything. But she could see that it was bent over where its waist would have been, looking down at the baby in a black cloak. Well, she became terrified. She was very young at the time, just a teenager, so she ran out of the house and ran next door to get her dad to come back and see what's going on. She was so freaked out, she did not take the baby. He came back, and by the time they got back, the baby had passed away in his crib. Wow. Now, Christina's grandmother recalls this incident very, very clearly. She said her sister was totally distraught. And this was the 1930s, so they had a hard time finding the family. It's not like you could make a phone call or anything. She remembers the whole family was up in the middle of the night trying to find the couple to tell them that their poor baby had passed away. Christina says, the uniqueness of the tale is why I wanted to share it. I've heard of little people, the fae, gnomes, but nothing like this story. And it has fascinated me since the first time I heard it. And that's the story of the little Reaper.
Wow. Wow. Now, you have a theory about this that's very interesting. We talked about it off air. Do you doubt this story a little bit?
No, I don't. I don't necessarily doubt the story. I said an alternate explanation. A skeptic might say something like, well, maybe something happened to the baby and the child used this as kind of a metaphor to explain what happened.
Okay.
But I don't have any reason to necessarily think that that the child did anything. There, the other possibilities, it was so traumatic, maybe it imprinted that on the child's mind. I think that might be more likely. But again, a lot of times I think things that we consider to be myths, I think, have some basis in truth. Like the idea of the Grim Reaper, maybe he really does pop around sometimes. Mm-hmm. Maybe the figure of death is real. It may not show up every time somebody dies, but maybe there is something to it. So I love family stories. That's what I love. I love, and I've said this, and I've done some live talks where I say at the end, I say, if you don't get anything else from this, and I share different stories and play clips and talk about them, share your stories. good, bad, happy, sad, paranormal or otherwise, share those family stories, because there's a saying, and I don't know exactly how it goes, but something like, you truly die when the last person speaks of you. You know, okay. Once you're dead, if people are still speaking about you and talking about you and sharing your stories and saying, oh, look what Jim used to do, or that time Jim did this. But when people start speaking and stop speaking about you in a way, that's when you truly die. So share those stories and live on, and let those stories live on for your family. Again, whether they're paranormal or they're not paranormal, I think family stories are so important.
Right. One last one here, Jim, before I let you go today. We, believe it or not, have a story in common.
Okay. And which one is that?
And it's in this book.
Okay.
There is a story in this book that has been shared here on the show. And it's in this book. And it has to do with a frog.
Oh, you know, I think he even told me that he had been on Darkness Radio. Yes. I know the one you're talking about now. Yeah.
Ray reached out to you. Yeah. Let me explain to the audience why I let you get a little bit of reference here. Ray had written into us years ago, and I think at the time, Dave and I looked at each other and said, I don't know that we can believe this, because we've never heard of the fact that a frog would visit somebody, let alone a frog that talks to you in a hallway.
Yeah.
And I think we both got a little bit of a giggle at first over it, because we didn't know if we could believe it. But then when we realized, because Ray contacted us more than once, and he goes, no, I'm serious. And we were like, oh, no, he's serious. But there's a part of the story we never got, and it's in your book.
Oh, cool. Yes. Well, I'll just say one thing. I don't necessarily discount people, because sometimes I think people can see things.
Yeah.
And their mind at the time interprets the one thing, and it might be something else. For example, I had a guy called in and said, when I was a kid, I used to see a leprechaun. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of similar to this story. In later years, his brother, he finally admitted this to his brother. I used to see a leprechaun. He said, oh, you saw it too. And the thing is that just because it even goes back to the Reaper story, maybe that wasn't a Reaper. Maybe it was some other kind of creature. But the child, because of the culture and because of the reference, internalized it as a Reaper, right? So it's kind of wild as it sounds that it's a frog. Well, maybe it wasn't a frog, but maybe it was some kind of evil entity.
Right.
That presented itself as a frog. But anyway, I'll tell the story.
Yeah, please.
So this is Ray, and he's at the time of this story, this has been several years ago, in his mid-40s, happened many years ago, when he was between the ages of 8 and 10. And he had trouble falling asleep. And he'd go to bed and just lay there for what seemed forever. He'd toss and turn. He shared a room with his one brother, Matt. And his other brother had his own room down the hall. And their mom would leave the bathroom light on in the hall so they could go to the restroom if they need to at nighttime. Now, for about a 2-month period, Ray would lay there and he would see a foggy, dark, shadowy shape down on the ground at the end of the hallway. At first, it was formless. It was just a dark blob. And over a few months, it started becoming much more defined. As things progressed, I could make out this figure shape and see something was there. Of course, when you're a little kid, you're not inclined to confront whatever it is. You're terrified. And he'd go to bed at around 8 o'clock, and these weird forms would show up around 10. And he'd see them over a period of hours. And he would finally go to sleep about 3:30 in the morning when a train would regularly go by. And he said after the initial period, the blob started to show itself as a toad. He said he knows it sounds crazy, but it would sit on its rear end, squatting and resting its hands on its knees. He could make it out very vividly. It was bumpy, but it wasn't wet like a frog. He said he could see it in light from the hallway, and it was brown with what looked like some yellow discolorations. He said it wasn't like a regular toad, though. It had clawed fingers, and he estimated its size. Since it stood on occasion, he'd say it was about 2 to 2.5 feet high. That's a big frog.
That is, yeah.
Or toad.
Yeah.
And he never mentioned this to his brother, because he didn't want to freak him out. He said it was bizarre because if you've seen a toad or a frog, this thing had all the same mannerisms. It would lick its eyes for moisture every so often, that sort of thing. And get this. He said one time he went to see what it was. He got up and started to walk towards it. The toad tensed up, raised itself up, and it spoke to him. The toad spoke to him, Tim. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Where are you going?" I was freaked out, but got the guts to say, "I'm going to the bathroom." He ran into the bathroom, thought, "I'm not going back down the hallway." Ended up sleeping in the tub that night. And his parents were like, in the morning, "Why are you sleeping in the tub?" And he claimed that he must have been sleepwalking. Of course, he didn't want to tell them about seeing a talking toad.
Right.
So he was in total panic mode in subsequent nights. He had his dog sleeping with him. He wouldn't let him leave. And he thought, finally, I got to do something. So he finds his hunting knife that his father made for him when he was young. He snuck it into his bedroom and put it under his pillow for about three nights. Now, folks, I don't recommend you do this. Anybody, younger people, don't get knives or anything like this. We do not recommend, do not try this at home. So anyway, he was trying to get his courage up. He didn't know what to do because it never entered his room or came after him, but it was very menacing. Finally, one night, he couldn't take it anymore. He said, "This thing's got to go. I can't look at it. It scares me." He said it was the most menacing thing he'd ever encountered. You could feel malevolence emanating from it. And he didn't know how to explain it any other way. Now, he felt the toad wanted him dead to hurt him or his brothers. He could just tell by the way he looked at it. So, again, he sees it. He gets up. He puts the knife behind his back, starts to walk towards it. And again, the toad raises up as if it's about to ask him, "What are you doing? Go back to bed." He drove the knife down towards the thing, Ray says. At that point, he ended up on his rear end. He was knocked down on the ground. He didn't know what happened. He felt like something had blown him away. He lost the knife for a moment. He was looking all over the place for this monster. He was a little kid who watched a lot of movies. He thought maybe it was on the roof. Who knows where it was? What happened to it? He couldn't find anything. It was gone. After that, he took the knife and he hid it so his dad wouldn't know he had it. He went back to bed. He didn't sleep at all that night, though. The next night, nothing came. The following night, nothing else. Nothing. For about 3 weeks, he kept a vigil for it every night, expecting it to return. And after a month or so, he figured it is gone, and it was right. So, basically, he said years later, he had read about people with similar type experiences, and he was talking with his brother Matt about it. And he'd never talked to his brother Matt about it. Had no idea that his brother Matt knew anything about this. And Ray said, "You know, I used to see this little toad," and Matt chimes in, "out in the hallway at night." And Ray confirmed it. And Matt, his brother, said, "I'll tell you something. The night you went at it without that knife, you stabbed down, and I thought it was going to bite your face off. You put the knife into its mouth, and it went out in a puff, like it vaporized something." He said, "That knocked you down." Ray was amazed. He said, "You saw me do that?" He said, "Absolutely. It knocked you down and you panicked. You were crawling all over the hallway. I give you credit because you weren't screaming. I wanted to scream." "I'd seen it for about a year," Matt said. "I didn't know you had seen it. And I didn't want to say anything to you either." So the other brother didn't see it. Now, Ray says, on second thought, as far as he's concerned, he thinks it was a demon. He says he's tried to look it up and found nothing on demonic frogs or toads. But still, "I've heard of other people having similar experiences since I talked about this on another show."
Yeah, there you go.
"I needed to tell somebody else what happened to me." So there you go. That's the story of the torment of the toad. When a story we share, that's right.
I want to apologize to Ray, if I can.
Well,
because And with age comes wisdom, as I drop my iPad. With age comes wisdom. Here's the deal. So as we were younger then, and probably not as mature as we should have been, there came a time where you get a story like that. And first of all, we didn't have the entire story because we didn't know about the brother knowing about it as well.
Right. Right.
And I don't think we knew about the knife and him actually vanquishing the thing. I think he just said at the time he had seen it and it had been coming back and forth, and we knew about the tub. Mm-hmm. I think we knew about, my memory's a little foggy about this. But, you know, he had the courage to come forward to us and tell us his story. And we didn't do him a good service. I really don't feel like we did him a good service. And that was always one of the ones I felt bad about, to be honest with you.
I'll be honest with you. It's one of those things, frankly, that I can understand on the face of it how you would reject it out of hand. I could understand that. But I always try to remember, and I'm not perfect all the time, believe me, but I always tried to keep in mind that people could be seeing certain things and interpreting, particularly young people, interpreting it in different ways. Not that it isn't supernatural, isn't paranormal, but it may not be that thing it's presenting to be. So as ludicrous as it sounds as somebody seeing a leprechaun, maybe that's the way that person interpreted it. That's the best bucket they could put it in their mind. So that's just what I try to keep in mind in cases like this.
True, but as I get older, I realize that, and I'm sure you can back me on this too. You should never be quick to judge, right? You should
right.
Listen to the story, listen to what it is that person has to say, and realize that this is something that somebody truly believes happened to them, and you want to give them some sort of respect and gravitas and let them air what it is that they've brought to you, because they have respect for you and they want your opinion, they want your ear, and they have respect enough for you to bring it what it is that it is weighing on them to you. You shouldn't turn around and, pardon my language, shit on them. Right. So right.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true, and I try to do that. I'm not perfect, but I try to make a welcoming place where anybody can tell me, an outlandish story, and I'm just going to listen, because that's what I'm there for, to listen and to share the stories. Let the audience judge for themselves. But I guess, Tim, in 15 years of doing that show, I think the vast majority of people are presenting things to me the way they believe that they happen to them, that they are being honest. I really believe that. I've had a couple of people, I could probably count on one hand, one person kept using a Howard Stern catchphrase. And it's like, I listened to Howard back in the day. I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then there was one woman, she made me laugh, because I asked people, don't read your story per se. Just kind of, if you have bullet points and notes, that's totally understandable. Just use it as a reference, but just tell it like you're telling to a friend, because
sure.
I am your friend.
Yeah.
And this one woman, I told her that, and she started reading, and I asked people to get their stories within 10 minutes because we want to get as many people as possible. And that's it. By radio standards, that's very generous.
Yeah, it is.
But
yeah.
We want to give people the space to tell the story, but we don't want a 30-minute monologue. And this woman was talking on, well, this happened to me and blah, blah, blah. And you could hear her moving the pages. And then I'm trying to interrupt her, and she's not listening. And then all of a sudden she yells in the other room, can you get my other book?
Oh,
and it's
geez.
Just like, so I just sat there and let her tell her story. I said, thank you very much. And that one never saw the light of day. But we air like 98-99% of all stories. And those are the exceptions. Most people are very kind. And my job is I want to meet them right there. I want to be just as kind, just as nice, just as welcoming, and come from a place of acceptance. And hey, we're around a campfire. I'm not going to invite you to a campfire to share stories and then pee all over your story.
right, yeah.
So that's just my kind of modus operandi. But nobody's perfect.
Right, nobody's perfect. But again, I do want to apologize to Ray and tell him, we were younger, we were a little more naive at that point, I feel like we fumbled the story a little bit with you, and I'm glad Jim did you a service and a justice with it. So I'm glad that it did come out the way it was supposed to come out with True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire, Volume 6. So there you go. That's what I wanted to state with that. So there you go. in the end, Ray got his story out.
That shows you're a great person because you're willing to say, hey, I made a mistake and I'm sorry. And that takes a big person to do.
Oh, well, thank you. The book is out there right now, folks. We've got a link to it in the description of the program. True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire Volume 6 is out now. I want you to go out, get it. It is a great book, folks. And in one of those books where, hey, if you need a couple of stories before you go to bed every single night, you've got stories for quite a while to get you to sleep and a little bit of a spookiness every night before you get to sleep. Tip of the cap to you and your team, Jim. A great book. And we've got links both to your podcasts and to the book in the description of this program. Jim, thank you so much for being with us, my friend.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And stay spooky.
I want to thank Jim Harold greatly for being on the program today. The book, again, in the description of the program. I want you to go out and get that book. Gosh, it's such a great book. I read it cover to cover, went through it very quickly. In fact, I think I read it in two sittings. I just started the first part of the book, and I sat down, read it for maybe about an hour, and then boom, the rest of it took me about 2.5 hours after that, and I read it that quickly. The stories are short stories. Total, in the book, there are 65 stories. Now, you may think that's a lot, but you know, when you're talking, I think the book is 235 pages. It's only a few pages per story. And it's one of those books where if you just want a few stories before you go to bed, you read a few stories, you're off to Never Never Land, you come on back, and you've got a few per night. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful book. Beautifully put together by Jim and his team. Again, the book is True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire 6. And what's nice about these books, like Jim pointed out earlier in the show, you want to read this book first, you can go back and get the other ones. And again, they're all great books. So I want to thank Jim again for being on the program. We also have links to his podcast as well, the Paranormal Podcast and Jim Harold's Campfire. I encourage you to check those out as well. Coming up on the weekend, folks, man, there's so much work ahead of me, but it's going to be so nice this weekend. And you know what? My nephew is up in my neck of the woods this weekend, so playing hockey. So I may take a little time for myself and go watch the nephew slap some puck around. That's what I'm going to do this weekend, I think. Also, Mother's Day weekend, an important weekend. And that, again, the ladies in my life mean so much. So I do want to say a happy Mother's Day to my mother, who has been one of my biggest fans for my entire life, not just for this part of my life and sitting here listening to me yap on a microphone, but for most my entire life. I want to say happy Mother's Day to my aunt, who's my godmother, who's also been another one of my biggest fans and supporters. And happy Mother's Day to, and my aunt, by the way, is also my godmother. So there you go. And also want to say happy Mother's Day to my sisters as well. My sisters and stepsisters, all of whom have gone above and beyond to be great mothers. So I want to wish them happy Mother's Day as well. And happy Mother's Day to all of you out there, whether you be mothers, stepmothers, whether you be aunts, whether you be godmothers, whether you be friends of the family who fill in and do amazing things in times of need, whether you be a positive female influence out there and fill in and play a parental role in some way or another, your feminine influence is greatly appreciated. And God bless you and thank you for what you do. For the rest of you guys who aren't doing anything, screw you. I know it's opening fishing. So there you go. I'm just kidding. But it's opening fishing this weekend too. So go out and get some, get something because we all need to eat. There you go. There's that too. Let's see. It's going to be a great weekend. I love this time of year. I love spring. I love good weather, and it's going to be a great weekend. So get out and enjoy it while you can. And grab somebody who maybe may not be able to get out of the house to help them enjoy it as well. Make that be your good deed for the weekend. That'll do it. Next week, we got a good week of shows. I can't tip you off anymore, folks. Every time I tip you off now, it seems like someone wants to steal my guest. So just trust me on this. Maybe look to social media. I might tease you next week. I want you to go to darknessradioshow.com. Check the events page. Again, Potographs for Pooches up at the Palmer. Get your tickets for that. If you can't join the event, then at least go to potographsforpooches.com. Pick up some swag. Help out the animals. Also, Michigan Paracon coming up in August. Get your tickets for that. You'll just click on that link in the events page on darknessradioshow.com. And check out the store. There'll be some new stuff coming really, really soon. So there you go. That'll do it. Have a great weekend. Love you guys. See you next week. Boy, have we got good stuff for you both on True Crime Tuesday and right here on the best in paranormal programming. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.